happy to hear your voice.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. The U.S. government has told China-based internet company ByteDance to sell its shares in the blockbuster TikTok app or face a national ban. U.S. news outlets say the ultimatum was posed by the agency charged with assessing the risk to national security from foreign investments. TikTok claims it has more than a billion users worldwide, including over 100 million in the United States, where it has become a cultural force, especially for young people. But the U.S. and the European Union have been taking an increasingly tough approach to the app, citing fears user data could be used or abused by Chinese officials. Concerns rose in Washington earlier this year after a Chinese spy balloon shot down in U.S. airspace. Swiss-based Credit Suisse Bank announced Thursday it will borrow up to $54 billion from the Swiss Central Bank. The bank said the loan will boost its liquidity after a slump in its shares intensified fears about a global financial crisis. The announcement helped stem heavy selling in financial markets and Asian morning trade on Thursday, following 3 days of volatile global trading. Has investors worried about a run on global bank deposits following the collapse of two prominent U.S. banks last week? Flights to and from Greece will be grounded, and ships will remain docked at ports on Thursday, as Greek workers are staging a massive walk-off on the job to protest last month's head-on collision of a passenger train and freight train that killed 57 people. It was the deadliest train crash in Greece's history. The 24-hour strike called by Greece's largest private and public sector unions is also expected to shut public services and state schools and disrupt urban transport. It is the latest in a series of protests since the head-on collision with more than 350 people on board a passenger train, most of them university students. This is VOA News. As the U.S. and Russia ramp up their rhetoric over Tuesday's destruction of an American drone, their defense chiefs have resumed contacts to discuss what happened. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
For the first time since October,
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin would not give details.
We take any potential for escalation very seriously.
This incident brought the two nations closest to direct conflict since the Ukraine invasion began a year ago. The U.S. says it was forced to ditch a $32 million surveillance drone in the Black Sea after a Russian fighter jet hit its propeller in international airspace. While Russia denies causing the incident, Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley says there's no denying the Russians harassed the drone. Sagar Magani, Washington.
In the areas of southern Africa worst hit by a tropical cyclone Freddy, people are trying to piece their lives back together. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has more.
On Wednesday, authorities said the death toll from what is one of the longest-lasting and strongest storms ever recorded in the southern hemisphere had risen above 270. The majority of the deaths are in Malawi. Others have been recorded since Freddy first made landfall in February in Mozambique and Madagascar. The storm tore through southern Africa for the second time at the weekend, and heavy rain persisted on Wednesday. Many around Blantyre have been killed in mudslides.
That was Reuters correspondent David Doyle. Syria's rebel-controlled Idlib province, hit hard by February's earthquakes, is looking to rebuild its shattered education infrastructure. Repairing and replacing destroyed schools is only part of the problem, with many children traumatized. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Many school children are now living in tent camps after their homes were destroyed. Some are just too frightened to return to school. Heba Assad says her children enjoyed school before the quake. Now she worries whether her children will be able to go back. She says because of the earthquake, children became hysterical with fear. International support is helping to set up tent schools, which are not only cheap and quick to erect, but also offer a psychologically safe environment for the children. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Repeating our top story, the U.S. government has told China-based internet company ByteDance to sell its shares in the blockbuster TikTok app or face a national ban. U.S. news outlets say the ultimatum was posed by the agency charged with assessing the risk to national security from foreign investments. You can find more on this story on our website, voanews.com. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Today is Thursday, March 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. begins to probe into crash of a surveillance drone as Russia races to recover the craft.
The incident is being investigated. I can't speak at this point to motive or to intent, but what I can say very clearly is this was a reckless and unsafe action, but we'll let the investigation proceed.
Thousands of supporters shield former Pakistani leader amid the government's plan to arrest him.
The Pakistan Tehreek Insaf Party of Mr. Khan has issued formal appeals to all their provincial leaders and activists across Pakistan to converge on Khan's residence.
And fears about a world banking system collapse spread to Europe as some shares plunge. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said on Wednesday that a U.S. military surveillance drone's crash into the Black Sea after being intercepted by Russian jets is being investigated. This as Russia says it will try to recover pieces of the drone. Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
U.S. forces brought down the drone after saying a Russian jet hit and damaged the MQ-9's propeller.
Russia does not have the drone.
Pentagon spokesman Pat Ryder yesterday. This morning, a Russian security official says Moscow will look for the drone's debris. Here in Washington, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby told CNN the drone has not been recovered, and the U.S. already took steps to minimize efforts by other nations to exploit the drone's content. The incident has deepened the diplomatic rift. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says relations with Washington are deplorable at their lowest point at the Pentagon.
A troubling episode yesterday.
Defense Chief Lloyd Austin says it continued a pattern of unsafe Russian actions. Sagar Magani, Washington.
China's foreign ministry has accused Australia of breaching global rules on the spread of nuclear weapons. That follows the announcement Monday of details of nuclear-powered submarines under the trilateral AUKUS security accord among Australia, the United States and Britain. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
China has accused the AUKUS alliance of embarking on a path of error and danger. Monday, the leaders of the United States, Britain and Australia announced a deal on nuclear-powered attack submarines that will also see US and British nuclear-powered submarines rotating into Australian waters as soon as 2027. The multi-billion dollar trilateral accords will provide Australia with at least three US-made submarines armed with conventional weapons. The Allies will also work together to create a new fleet of subs using cutting-edge technology. At a regular media briefing in Beijing Tuesday, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said the AUKUS partners had, for the sake of their own geopolitical interests, completely disregarded the concerns of the international communities. China has previously accused Washington, London and Canberra of a Cold War mentality. Senior Australian government ministers telephoned their counterparts in more than 60 nations in the days leading up to Monday's AUKUS announcement to allay concerns about nuclear proliferation. China, however, has so far refused to be briefed. Australia's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Wednesday that her government wanted to be more transparent than the former Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who signed the AUKUS Accord in September 2021.
We wanted to stabilise the relationship with China and we want to re-engage more deeply with our region. We've sought to do both of those things, including in the way we've dealt with this announcement, where we've engaged very closely with our region in the lead up to this and made sure that they weren't blindsided in the way they were under the Morrison government. I said we wanted to cooperate with China where we can, disagree where we must, and we would engage in our national interests.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said Australia's twin ambitions of greater military cooperation with the United States and closer economic ties with China, its biggest trading partner, was not a contradictory position. Canberra's diplomatic ties with Beijing have been strained in recent years over various political and trade disputes. But Albanese's centre-left government has made improving the relationship a priority. The Australian Prime Minister met Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the G20 International Summit in Indonesia in November. Albanese visits Fiji Wednesday to hold talks on security, climate change and the regional economy with his counterpart Sitiveni Rambuka. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
US Secretary of State Antony Blinken on a one-day visit to Ethiopia emphasized the importance of keeping the peace in Tigray region after 2 years of bloody civil war. Maya Mercer reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Ethiopian Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Demeke Mekonnen on Wednesday as part of his one-day working visit to the country. During brief remarks made at the start of their official meeting, Blinken sounded optimistic about the November peace deal signed between the Ethiopian federal government and Tigrayan forces.
It's very, very good to be back in Africa, especially to be Ethiopia. I think a very important moment of hope given the peace in the north that is taking hold and that seems to move forward.
Blinken added, there's a lot to be done, but the most important thing is to continue to deepen the peace that is now taking hold in the north. The meeting was attended by other high-level officials, including U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia Tracy Ann Jacobson and Ethiopian Ambassador to the U.S. Selassie Bekele. During the meeting, officials discussed the establishment of an interim regional administration in Tigray, which was part of the November peace deal. The Ethiopian government has lifted blockades into the region since the deal, allowing the entry of humanitarian aid, and Tigrayan forces have handed over heavy weapons to the Ethiopian government. Officials today also discussed a transitional justice policy that will bring about accountability and redress for victims, according to a statement from the Ethiopian government. Rights group Amnesty International has recently called on the U.S. Secretary of State to make human rights issues central to the talks. Ethiopia has been lobbying to cut short a UN-backed investigation on human rights violations in the country, which it has said is politically motivated. A report by the UN investigators, rejected by Ethiopia, found widespread violations by both sides during the war, including the government's use of starvation as a method of warfare. Maya Misakir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Thank you, Maya. Pakistani security forces withdrew from around Imran Khan's home on Wednesday, putting a halt to clashes that had erupted after police tried to arrest the former prime minister for not showing up in a case against him related to selling state gifts. Rachel Graham of Reuters reports.
Clashes had erupted between police and Khan's supporters after officials tried to detain the former prime minister. Security forces had fired tear gas and water cannons at hundreds of Khan's supporters who had cordoned off his home in an effort to prevent his arrest. Police say a court in Islamabad ordered Khan's arrest for not appearing before it despite repeated summons in relation to selling state gifts given by foreign dignitaries during his premiership. Pakistan's Election Commission found him guilty in the matter and now a criminal inquiry is underway, though Khan says he broke no rules. Police and other security personnel were seen leaving the Lahore neighbourhood where Khan's home is located on Wednesday. A senior police official said the operation to arrest Khan had been paused to accommodate a cricket tournament in the Pakistan Super League being played nearby. Khan accused the incumbent government of attempts on his life in a video released by his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. His life was in danger, he said, claiming that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and an intelligence agent had planned tear gas shelling on his home. After forces withdrew, Khan was seen standing outside his home wearing a gas mask and talking to supporters. The violence has added to the instability in the country, which is struggling with an economic crisis and awaiting an International Monetary Fund bailout.
That's Rachel Graham of Reuters. And former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan remained holed up in his home in Lahore, shielded by thousands of supporters and surrounded by dozens of security personnel. His lawyers will attempt on Thursday to get a court exemption to appear personally for a Saturday hearing to answer corruption charges, citing security threats to his life. As tensions continue to rise, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gal.
PTI, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party of Mr. Khan, has issued formal appeals to all their provincial leaders and activists across Pakistan to converge on Khan's residence and come and gather there as soon as possible. So that means that the party realizes and still knows that the police may go for an action immediately tomorrow morning after the court hearing in Islamabad. So that the number of people that have gathered, it's huge there. So it seems that even if another attempt is made tomorrow to get him arrested before Saturday, we may see again this standoff. These supporters are there. We have seen live footages on local television, and in fact, social media actively is releasing all these footages from outside Imran Khan's residence in Lahore. There is no indication of any scaling back from the party telling workers to go home. There are ladies, there are families, young people. They're all there. Every now and then they issue statements that they're determined to prevent their leader from being arrested.
Yesterday, for several hours, there were pitched battles between the police and supporters of Imran Khan. Has there been any arrests? Analysts are speculating and expressing fears that if this is not taken care of, if it has the potential to explode.
To some extent, true that if this demonstration against the arrest, possible arrest of Imran Khan continues, it may really plunge the country into some kind of a chaotic situation. This fear has been there from the day one. But police have rounded up dozens of people, even in Lahore and elsewhere in Pakistan. We know for sure from official statements that people have been arrested in Islamabad, here in the capital, in the neighboring city of Rawalpindi and other cities. But that has not deterred Imran Khan's party activists from, you know, coming out on the streets and participating in this agitation. So obviously, it all depends on how the government treats Imran Khan. Cases against him are such that there is always possibility for a court to issue a bailable arrest for a suspect. And in case of Imran Khan, he's expecting that when he appears before the court, attends the hearing, he should be able to get a protective bail. If the government goes ahead with that, you know, we may see more violent protests in Pakistan.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. In other news, fears about the world banking system spread to Europe as shares in the global connected Swiss bank Credit Suisse plunged. The steep drop on Wednesday dragged down other major European lenders in the wake of bank failures in the United States. At one point, Credit Suisse shares lost more than a quarter of their value. The stock price hit a record low after the bank's biggest shareholder, the Saudi National Bank, told news outlets that it would not invest more money into the Swiss lender. Credit Suisse was beset by problems long before the U.S. banks collapsed. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Middle Eastern analysts are divided on the news of the surprise diplomatic rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, brokered by China. Some view the development as potentially positive for Lebanon and perhaps Yemen, where Tehran exerts great influence, but other observers are cautious, with some speculating that Iran is simply trying to alleviate the current pressure it is facing. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
Generally, Middle East analysts welcome the news of the resumption of diplomatic ties between volatile rivals Saudi Arabia and Iran in the hopes that it will lessen regional tensions and increase stability. Maha Yahya, who directs the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, says the deal's timing was opportune, especially for Iran, given the collapsing economic situation there and mounting international pressure, especially after the failure to revive the nuclear deal and Iranian progress in enriching uranium. This is all the more significant in that the country has been facing months of domestic protests. Lebanese analyst Dania Kholia Khatib told VOA that both Iran and Saudi Arabia could gain from stability if the deal takes hold. Khatib is the president of the Beirut-based Research Center for Cooperation and Peace Building.
The Iranians, to a certain extent, will hold on to it because they don't have any other choice. They're under great pressure. There's pressure inside, there's pressure outside. There is no for the revival of the TPPOA. The best thing for them is to make peace with their neighbors. All the instability coming from Iran, Hezbollah, the Houthis. If there is an agreement with Iran, and Iran follows through, it will decrease the instability in the region.
Vision 2030 is Saudi Arabia's ambitious economic reform plan, aiming to reduce its dependence on oil production by diversifying into industry, logistics, tourism, and other sectors. Khatib says both Saudi Arabia and Iran may be willing to make concessions and agree to a compromise presidential candidate in Lebanon as a result of the deal. Yet others are less optimistic. Analysts say it could also speed up peace talks between Saudi Arabia and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, who have claimed drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities. But Dina Esfandiari of the International Crisis Group told the French news agency AFP that if it's just a Saudi-Houthi deal, there will be an issue inside Yemen with the grievances of various other parties that aren't being addressed, including the main separatist faction, the Southern Transitional Council. Farhad Razai, a senior fellow at the Philos Project New York, is skeptical about Iranian hardliners truly wanting to normalize ties with Saudi Arabia, saying in a tweet that once the pressure subsides, they will likely revert to their previous hostile stance given their religious and geopolitical conflicts. He points to previous failed attempts by the custodians of Sunni and Shiite Islam to reconcile. Still, Faisal Abbas, who is the editor-in-chief of the Saudi Arab News, says it would have been irresponsible for the Saudi leadership not to give peace a chance. But he also points out that it is early days. We cannot expect 4 decades of Iranian hostility and investment in undermining regional security to disappear overnight, he says. Dale Gaffleck for VOA News, Amman.
French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to Central Africa this month has received mixed reviews, with some skeptical of his latest reset of French relations with the continent. It's part of a broader challenge Macron faces in asserting French influence, not just in Africa but also in Europe, amid a fast-changing political landscape marked by the war in Ukraine and Russia's growing influence overseas. From Paris, Lester Bryant reports for VOA.
A little music in Kinshasa to end President Macron's four-nation visit to Central Africa in early March, but not everything finished on a light note. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is not a former French colony, some protested Macron's visit. Macron may face an uphill road selling his revamped Africa strategy, one he put to the test in his latest trip to the continent, which also included stops in Gabon, Angola, and the Republic of Congo. In February, Macron outlined an Africa policy marked by a reduced military footprint and balanced and respectful relations. In its former colonies, France is competing for influence against countries like China and Russia. Closer to home, French influence is being questioned in the European Union. Some analysts see the war in Ukraine shifting Europe's power center eastward, away from traditional heavyweights France and Germany, to countries like Poland with tougher views on Russia. These countries and Ukraine have criticized Macron's call for maintaining dialogue with Moscow and considering its need for security guarantees. Critics say Macron's push for a more autonomous European defense has failed to gain traction. Still, other analysts believe France will remain an important player in a Europe defined by more than the Ukraine conflict. The Ukraine war has made defense a top European priority. Analysts like Kinsey believe Macron's vision of a more militarily independent EU may ultimately resonate if next year's U.S. elections bring in a leadership less committed to the transatlantic alliance and to investing in a potentially long and costly conflict in Ukraine. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is Science in a Minute.
Jupiter's ice and water-covered moon Europa has long fascinated scientists because it may be one of the more likely places in our solar system that could have environments that are suitable for life outside of Earth. Significant scientific evidence, including data from NASA's probes, shows a giant swirling ocean of salty water or mushy ice lying beneath Europa's crust. It has also been found that its crust rotates at a different rate than its interior. A new computer model by NASA scientists is providing evidence that this subsurface ocean is pushing around Europa's possibly free-floating icy crust and is causing its rotation to speed up and slow down over time. The scientists are hoping that measurements by NASA's upcoming Europa Clipper mission to the Jovian moon will confirm and provide more details to their findings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA. Next up, an update on North Africa and the Middle East. We talk with the director of North Africa programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace about what's behind the resumption of ties between arch rivals Saudi Arabia and Iran, and what is the state of play in Libya. Join me and VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi for a conversation with Eli Abuaoun this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 16th marks the 35th anniversary of the most egregious case of murder by poison gas of Iraqi civilians by their own leader, Saddam Hussein. On that day in 1988, Iraqi bombers filled the skies over Halabja, a town of some 60,000 people. They shelled the city all day, breaking windows and doors and forcing people to take shelter in their cellars. As dusk fell and for 5 hours into the night, airplanes and helicopters peppered Halabja with a different sort of weapon, canisters of mustard gas, nerve agents, and other chemical weapons. Heavier than air, the toxic chemicals seeped into the buildings and crept down to where people huddled in fear. Some 5,000 civilians died as a direct result of the toxic chemicals dropped on Halabja. Around 10,000 more were blinded, maimed, or disfigured. In the decades that followed, thousands more died from horrific health complications and debilitating diseases. To this day, the survivors of the Halabja attack suffer from increased levels of colon cancer and respiratory diseases and high rates of miscarriages and infertility. For decades, the Iraqi regime tried to put down restive Kurdish populations in the country's northern provinces. The chemical attack on Halabja was part of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's genocidal onfall campaign, an intensification of the attacks on the Kurds, which lasted from February to September 1988. In March of that year, Saddam Hussein put his cousin Hassan al-Majid in charge of the operation. Later that month, Iraq's Revolutionary Command Council issued Decree No. 160, granting him a free hand in conducting the campaign. Even prior to the onfall campaign, al-Majid, later dubbed Chemical Ali, decided to use chemical weapons to eliminate strongholds of resistance. In the May 26, 1987 recording of a meeting, Chemical Ali declares, "I will kill them all with chemical weapons. Who is going to say anything? The international community?" After the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime in 2003, Chemical Ali was tried for crimes against humanity and genocide, found guilty and executed on January 25, 2010. The instigator of the onfall campaign, Saddam Hussein, was found guilty of crimes against humanity and executed in 2006. The attack on Halabja lives in infamy. The city was razed to the ground in July 1988 and eventually rebuilt. Today, it lives again, a home to nearly a 250,000 people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.